You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The famous Dane County Farmers Market is back for another year, but before you show up, there are some changes you need to know about. We'll tell you what to expect coming up. Now, the state says that almost 80,000 Wisconsinites may have to repay tens of millions of dollars in unemployment money that was overpaid to them. Overpayment is a common part of the unemployment benefit process. It happens for a number of reasons, like an employer contesting claims or mistakes made, either by the recipient or by the state during the benefit claiming process. But for many people, the scale, the numbers involved, grew significantly after the coronavirus pandemic left many without jobs. And now the normal process for fighting the state's decision on overpayments is backlogged, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you apply for unemployment in the last year? How did it go for you? And have you gotten a notice from the state at this point saying, hey, maybe you owe back unemployment benefits yourself? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rob Mentzer is Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks.
And also with us today, Andrew Stettner, senior fellow at the Century Foundation, a progressive think tank focused on economic, racial, and gender equity. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, Rob, let's start with you. You've been reporting on this overpayment issue. What is going on?
Right. So this is, as you say, this is all sort of a consequence of the way that the state systems were overwhelmed early last year. There are all these sort of follow on consequences that flow from that. And because, as you say, certain amount of overpayment notices are just a normal part of administering the unemployment system. There could be just a clerical error that causes somebody to get a bit more than they are entitled to by law, and they sometimes have to pay it back. There are some cases of fraud that the state needs to chase down as well. That is something that happens. But in this case, because there have been so many, there were so many claims filed in such a short time, and then a long backlog that prevented them from being paid out for a very long time, it's like pushed each step of the process back. And now we are in a situation where a lot of people in Wisconsin are getting these overpayment notices, sometimes for like the full amount of their benefit or these very large numbers that accrued over a long period of time. And so, you know, for instance, I can talk about, I talked with a family who right now they're being told that they owe like $13,000 to the state. And they're saying there's no way we can pay this back.
And Andrew, we've talked a lot on this show about Wisconsin being overwhelmed, its rusty unemployment compensation computer system being overwhelmed by this, a lot of time taken to catch up. Andrew, is this just a Wisconsin story or are other states struggling with similar situations?
I think Wisconsin certainly has its own share of struggles, but it's not unique. This whole system across the country has been underinvested in and was really not ready for the situation. And there's been a lot of backseats when it comes to people that got unemployment benefits and were later found to have received an overpayment. And like Rob said, not for fraud, but really an error either on the state's part or when the more information came to light.
And why, Andrew, have so many states left these old systems in place? I think Wisconsin's a lot of the programming happened in the 1970s and early 1980s. The interfaces look familiar to anybody who played computer games circa 1985. Why wasn't there more investment before we had this overwhelming situation of the COVID economic shutdown?
You know, unfortunately, sympathy for the unemployed goes away really fast. After a down period, and the grants to states, have really not kept up with inflation. States really rely on federal grants, and they've been very limited. We've just invested a lot less in unemployment than we have in other programs like healthcare.
Now, Rob, with people facing this overpayment situation, I know one of the examples you gave in a piece you wrote about this at WPR.org. Somebody applied in good faith and later got this back pay bill saying their employer had contested their claim. So what could you talk about that situation? What happens then?
Right. And so this, you know, it is noteworthy that this affected a lot of people who did not have experience with this, with the unemployment system. They're not people who had claimed this benefit in the past, but the pandemic was an extraordinary circumstance. A lot of people lost jobs early last year. And then the federal government also was, you know, it had boosted the benefit that people received. And so that's another thing that, that led to a lot of what we're seeing now, these amounts being somewhat inflated. So in particular, I spoke with a woman named Annie Knudsen, who lives in Appleton, and she had a part-time job driving a van for a martial arts school. She would pick the kids up from the elementary school and take them to the martial arts school. And then during the stay-at-home order, the school closed down. They did not offer any classes for months, and she was out of work. You can't be a driver if there's no kids to drive. There's no schools and there's no martial arts school. So then the school reopened in July, around July, sometime late July, and she declined to come back to work. So from her point of view, that is the period of her unemployment. And she applied for that and got it. But then the employer has contested that, and said that she refused to work, remotely in the interim, and that she quit and wasn't, you know, it wasn't a layoff. Now that's, again, like there's an appeals process. She'll have a chance to make her case, and the employer will too. And that's going to be adjudicated. But the problem, once again, because of the overwhelmed system, is that appeals process itself is going to take over a year right now, the backlog there. And so in the meantime, they have this overpayment notice hanging over their head for $13,000, and no option to, in the immediate future, take care of that.
We're talking about Wisconsin's unemployment system, concerns about back payment issues too. Rob Mentzer is with us, WPR reporter, and Andrew Stettner, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. You can join in if you have questions or experiences to share dealing with unemployment, maybe yourself or in your family or for your employees over the last year. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew, we just heard from Rob, you know, a lot of people, first timers in effect in the unemployment system in this last year. Are there changes you think could be made at the state level, or maybe coming from the federal level, to make the process a little more clear, a little less confusing, a little more transparent for people using it, apart from, you know, the back end technology?
I just want to jump in on some of the things that Rob said, so people out there are really clear. You know, there has been an issue where people would file for benefits, they get paid, and more information comes to light, and they end up being assessed an overpayment. It's very lucky that the claimant that Rob mentioned did file that appeal. That freezes the ability for the state to garnish things like your tax return, or even your stimulus payment. So it's really important for people out there that they get a notice of overpayment, even if they're confused by it, like a new person, go ahead and file that appeal for it, especially if you feel like you've been wronged in that overpayment decision. So I did want to emphasize that, you know, we need these systems that are out there to be designed in a user-friendly manner, with plainer language that is given to claimants to answer their questions. We need information systems that people can access in different ways, not just on the web, but actually talking to someone, you know, when they have questions. So there's a lot of ways that we can improve, you know, this system, you know, that's out there. And, you know, when it comes to overpayments, you know, we need in Wisconsin and other places, you know, we need to be interpreting the law in a way that's favorable to claimants. That's usually in the very first sentence of the unemployment law. But often, you know, when someone, you know, is late to work or simply can't do their job well, they might be denied unemployment benefits for saying they committed misconduct. So the way the rules have been interpreted has really angled against workers and gone against the purpose of the statute. So the agencies that are out there, you know, need to be making sure that they're interpreting the law fairly. And if they haven't gotten information in a timely fashion, They shouldn't deny people benefits months and months later.
We're talking about Wisconsinites being asked to return unemployment benefit money that was allegedly at least overpaid to them, and wider issues surrounding the unemployment system here in Wisconsin and around the nation. Our guests are Rob Metzer, WPR Rural Communities reporter based in Wausau, and Andrew Stettner, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. And you, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234. Did you experience that backlog yourself or someone in your family dealing with unemployment when so many people lost jobs temporarily or permanently with the beginning of the pandemic? Are you still working on those issues? Have you gotten one of these back payment notifications yourself? And do you have questions about how all this works? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about unemployment insurance in Wisconsin and overpayments and how some Wisconsinites are being asked to give some of their payments back to the state. Rob Metzer is with us, WPR Rural Communities reporter based in Wausau, and Andrew Stettner, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your own experiences or questions. Bill is with us in Stevens Point. Bill, hello.
Hi. Yes, my daughter was working as a waitress up in Stevens Point, and when COVID hit, all of a sudden all the restaurants need to be shut down, and so she was unemployed, applied for unemployment insurance, and she was rejected, and I kind of helped go through the appeal process, and they rejected her again on the appeal, and we could never figure out exactly what would have prevented somebody, you know, in the food industry from getting unemployment, you know, for that whole entire time that the COVID had shut down all the restaurants.
Well, Bill, thanks for sharing that story. Good luck to your daughter. Andrew, I've heard the sense over this last year that sometimes the unemployment process can be kind of this black box. You put in your information and you're not sure why you get the result that you do. Do you see an effort to make things more transparent around the country?
No, I think there have been a lot of problems. People may not have earned enough. They may have been a problem with their identity. And often, you know, they don't get a clear understanding. And I do think we have, you know, a real push to have the federal government put on some more clear standards, just some new rules today that if you're claim is being questioned, you need to get a clear notice in the mail and on the website about why it's being questioned. So I do think there is a reckoning that we can't just leave this to chance and leave so much up to the states, who are really clearly overwhelmed, unfortunately, you know, by the task of handling the unemployment system.
And Rob, that uncertainty, that is a common theme for the families you talk to and some of the people who represent people in this overpayment situation. This is hanging over their head, and they don't know when it's going to be resolved.
Without a doubt. I mean, I follow some of these, there are Facebook groups that are about sort of support for Wisconsinites who are in the unemployment system right now. And it's just a lot of frustrated people. The systems are complex and labyrinthine and hard to benefit or, you know, hard to navigate. And you get different competing, conflicting messages at multiple steps of the way. It's not ideal, Rob.
Thanks for that call. Before I go back to our callers, Andrew, I talked to our new secretary designee of our Workforce Development Department, who's in charge of this stuff, Amy Pacek, a while back. And she said one effort they're doing is trying to use, I don't know the exact words she used, but basically human language when people are filling out their forms and getting the results, as opposed to sort of this bureaucratic babble that would be confusing to just about anyone, regardless of the level of education. Is that something you think needs to happen more, using language that is understandable in this process?
Well, unfortunately, states out of fear basically just cut and paste from the state law and ask individuals whether they fit those components. I've dealt with overpayment cases when someone says they were laid off, but they were really fired. If you jump to Webster's Dictionary under fired, it will say laid off as one of the synonyms. But those are legally totally different terms when it comes to UI. And so we really do need to dig in and get people to tell their story in their own terms that can be interpreted. You know, technology can help with that. You know, one huge problem we've had, and I have sympathy, you know, the basic bottom line for the system used to be, if you can't understand the website, call and talk to someone. But as, you know, Rob knows from spending time with people, it's almost impossible to get through. You may be on hold for days at a time. And, you know, the people on the other end may have been just recently hired and they may not have the expertise to really answer your question. So it has really complicated the situation. And it's made a real understanding that we have to improve the front end of the system. And I do want to call out, I know the state of Wisconsin has, you know, contracted and working with some of the best people in the country on this to really retool the way in which they take unemployment claims. So I do hope that your listeners will see a better system, you know, in the next couple of years.
Let's go back to our callers now. Eric is with us in Milwaukee. Eric, hello.
Hey, yeah, I was just looking for your advice. My wife's been filing weekly claims since June, and she got denied and filed an appeal and missed one of her appeals. And so then there was a hearing on the appeal, and that was denied. And so we're just kind of lost. We're not sure whether we're going to keep fighting or we just want to know what you think.
Eric, thanks for the call. Andrew, let's throw this one to you. I know you don't know the specific circumstance here, but in general, for somebody dealing with that ongoing process, appeals, denials, do you have thoughts on ways for them to proceed?
It's difficult to deal with a non-timely appeal. You'd have to have generally extraordinary circumstances to request an additional appeal. You know, so that's why it is, I would just have to say it is important, you know, just to be really focused on that, you know, but there, if there's a really good cause reason, you know, for while that appeal is missed, you may be able to, you know, request a new appeal.
Thanks a lot for that call and good luck to you. Time for another caller or two. Tom is with us in Cornell. Tom, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Tom?
So I've kind of got the opposite problem. A lot of people here is not overpayment, but technically underpayment. I'm self-employed, or have been self-employed for 15 years. The year before all this hit, I made $36,000. And I was supposed to qualify. I'm a gig worker. I do sound and lights. Our industry was shut right down. And in the meantime, I've taken a couple of part-time jobs over the last couple of years that were W-2. So when I filed my unemployment for getting shut down, all they would qualify me for was $71 a week. Based off of my W-2s, they wouldn't let me file for the self-employment. You know, it was so bad. I sold my house. I had a $205,000 house. I sold it and bought a $90,000 shack 40 miles away.
Thanks a lot for that call. Sorry to hear that, Rob. I know your recent reporting looked at overpayment, but I imagine you're hearing from people in the community that either didn't get any unemployment or, as in our caller's case, got less than they thought they might be eligible for.
Well, sure. And yeah, I mean, as right. And he's this, that case, which is really striking. I mean, that is an example right there where within the sort of unemployment bureaucracy, they accepted these W-2s from this part-time work. But they did not accept this, you know, him being self-employed, which would have entitled them to these larger payments. So
I hope the listener knows that the December stimulus bill, thanks to people like him who advocated for this problem, unfortunately, the fundamental rule is that W-2 earnings have to come first because it's a state benefit before the federal benefit. Mm-hmm. But there was lots of people in this problem. People like him are eligible for an additional $100 per week starting January 2nd for weeks of unemployment. Wisconsin has agreed to be part of this program, which is called Mixed Earner Unemployment Compensation. But they're one of at least half the states that have accepted this program that have not put it into place. You are going to have to apply for this program. You are going to have to establish that you had at least $5,000 in net self-employment income in 2019 to get that extra $100 per week. So you just have to keep your eyes peeled for when that application becomes available. By law, they're supposed to notify everybody, but I wouldn't trust that. Just keep your eye open to when that application will come, and you would get back payments. I mean, given where Wisconsin is, we may be well into the year, second half of the year before the application becomes available, but you will be able to get back payments at $100 per week, from January all the way through September 6th under current law. So that would be another $4,000, for this caller and others in his situation.
Got a note from our producer here. The Department of Workforce Development expects that mixed earner income program to be up and running by May 19th. Very briefly, Andrew, just a few moments left. Other things to watch for in the latest federal relief package when it comes to unemployment?
One thing to watch for is the benefit year problem. If you've been on unemployment for a year and worked part-time, you may have to reapply for benefits. Those also could be a lower amount, but the law does not allow you to be decreased by more than $25. So just be aware of that, but don't reapply even if you have a benefit year end date if you have not worked at all in the prior year. It's a very confusing situation, but basically if you have not worked at all, don't reapply. It's just going to mess up your claim.
We'll leave it there. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And Rob, thanks for being with us. We'll watch for more of your reporting on this.
Thank you.
Been talking to Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio's rural communities reporter based in Wausau, and Andrew Stettner, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. We talked to them about why people in Wisconsin and across the country are being told they've been overpaid unemployment benefits, and looking at some of the challenges facing the unemployment system over the last year in Wisconsin, and as we heard, around the country, and the latest efforts to try to catch up and modernize the technology at the center of those systems. Coming up, a longtime Madison tradition is back, the Dane County Farmers Market. We'll look at how it's going to work and how organizers are trying to keep people safe as farmers markets are reopening now around the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. It's farmers market season in Wisconsin, with local markets reopening all over the state as things warm up. But with COVID-19, things look a little different. The Dane County Farmers Market had been held at the Capitol Square in Madison for decades. You could get all kinds of fresh veggies, meats, cheeses, flowers, and specialty products sold by the people who produce them. Organizers say it's the largest producer-only farmers market in the country. Then came COVID-19. Organizers eventually moved the Saturday morning tradition a few miles south to the Alliant Energy Center, where there's more room to spread out. Now it's back outdoors for another year, still at Alliant for now. Before you head over to check it out, there's some rules and procedures to check out. Jill Grundyke is co-manager of the Dane County Farmers Market. Jill, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, whether it's the Dane County Farmers Market in Madison or anywhere, why are farmers markets important to their local communities?
I mean, I often like to think of farmers markets as sort of hitting all of these goals and desires we have, especially in the 21st century. So farmers markets are sources of high quality, nutritious local foods. So fruits, vegetables, meats, cheeses, bakery goods as well. And then I think they're so important to our communities too, because of the source of connection we get and the community building that they bring to our region.
Now, the Dane County Market traditionally has the backdrop of the state capitol, a crowded audience in the square. A lot of people like this thing. What was it like moving it to a new venue?
I mean, to say the least, it was a little overwhelming. I mean, like so many other institutions and organizations, I mean, we were adapting and pivoting and coming up with new operations with days notice, with weeks notice. So it took a lot of organizational resources, but I mean, we pulled it off like so many other farmers markets in the area. But it's honestly been extremely heartening during our modified operations. You know, on the whole, they've been super successful, and our customers and our farmers are so excited that they still get to connect with each other during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Now, a lot of stores have shifted to curbside pickup, restaurants too, and you've been doing something along those lines. How does that work, given that there's so many different vendors to pick up from?
Yeah, so honestly, this is one of the first things that we tackled in March and April 2020, is we researched what's a good third-party platform that we can get our vendors on, and our customers can order from a bunch of our vendors all at once in one transaction. And so we partnered with What's Good, which is a platform that works with farmers markets and farmers. And basically, customers can get onto our DCFM online store, browse what's available, check out within one transaction, and then they come to... So right now, we're doing a Wednesday local food pickup. And so if they order from our Wednesday store, they drive through and each vendor puts their pre-ordered products contactlessly in their vehicle. People also can actually pre-order for a Saturday market. Folks will just pick up those pre-ordered items on foot from each vendor at our market.
And I know a lot of people want to go back to the old-fashioned way of just wandering around at the market, but I understand this is pretty popular with some customers and vendors. Do you think this sort of curbside thing will stick around even when we're back to normal?
So I think this is a big question mark, is like what's the stickiness, so to speak, of these new ways of doing business? Are they going to stick around? So far, you know, we are interested in potentially continuing to do the pre-ordering, even when we move back to the Capitol Square. It's honestly been, you know, we were sort of forced to innovate, but a lot of our vendors and a lot of our patrons have really enjoyed the ability to meal plan and guarantee they're going to get certain products at market.
Now, if I go to the 2021 Farmers Market now at the Alliant Energy Center, walk me through what to expect. What do I need to know? What am I going to see?
Yeah, so I guess the first thing I would want to notify people is that so we have moved locations at Alliant. So folks who came out last year will be familiar that we were at Willow Island at Alliant. But for the 2021 season, we are in the parking lot of the exhibition hall at Alliant Energy Center. So patrons can enter the main entrance of Alliant at Alliant Energy Center Way. And the market, as well as the customer parking, is right to your left. And so you'll turn left, park in any of the available parking spaces. And honestly, the market area is just a very short walk away from the parking. But patrons will see rows of vendors. So kind of a very traditional market layout, but they'll right around this time of year, they'll see about 50 to 55 of our farmers, bakers, and cheesemakers arranged in rows. Certainly, they're physically distanced from each other per our operations plan with public health. But they can move in any direction, wander the market, and shop from our vendors. Certainly, they'll see lots of signage on site about our public health guidelines in place. So masks are required for patrons 5 years or older. And physical distancing is also in effect.
Now, farmers markets, a big tradition, not just in Dane County, but around the state. Have you and your colleagues at other farmers markets been trading ideas and solutions and stealing them back and forth?
Honestly, that happened a lot early on. So last 2020 season, there was a lot of work both on the state level, and we're a part of sort of the national peer network of farmers markets. And there was a lot of sharing of certainly best practices, but also innovative ideas. Everybody was figuring stuff out all at once, and we definitely helped each other out.
As you look to the future, I don't think there's a date yet, but what kind of considerations are there as you hopefully want to return to the Capitol Square setting for the big market?
Yeah, so I know this is a question on so many folks' minds. We can't share an exact date of when we hope to reopen on the Capitol Square, but we are very confident we will return sometime during the 2021 season. And we are working very closely with both Capitol Police, who issues our permit for the Capitol Square, as well as Public Health Madison-Dane County, to see exactly what parameters have to be in place so that we can safely reopen.
And Jill, maybe you're too busy working on the market to be able to appreciate it, but is there a seasonal produce that you're really looking forward to yourself?
So honestly, this time of year, because this is a quite early time of the year in terms of crop production.
Yes.
So people will mainly see fresh greens, but in all honesty, arugula is one of my favorite vegetables, and this is like an ideal time for arugula. Of course, I also can't wait for asparagus to come around in about the early May timeframe.
Jill, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Jill Grundyke is co-manager of the Dane County Farmers Market in Madison. We talked to her about the return of this year's market and some of the safety considerations facing markets around the state. It's being held not at the Capitol right now, but at the Alliant Energy Center's Exhibition Hall parking lot every Saturday starting at 7 a.m. You can shop online. We've got details at WPR.org/Central Time. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a profile in an art exhibit that celebrates a community's diversity.
A lot of us have felt isolated this past year. And on top of the coronavirus pandemic, a national reckoning on race has forced many of us to consider our own identities, the ways they overlap, and the privileges they afford. WPR's Megan Hart visited an art show in Manitowoc that looks at how these concepts intersect and comes at the perfect time.
On a sunny Saturday in early spring, Sonia Vasquez set up her painting supplies in a bright and airy corner of Manitowoc's Rahr West Art Museum. She got to work finishing a portrait of a man, one of 10 she's painting for a show called Portrait of Manitowoc. She usually starts with a photograph.
And then what I do is lay down a layer of paint, and then I sort of take some of that paint off to, like, reveal some of the lighter spots. So it's kind of a give and take sort of thing with the paint at first.
The paintings are small, but they're rich in detail. Each one takes about 6 hours. Vasquez worked with museum curator Diana Bolander to create the exhibit.
So I wanted to try to find a way to marry those two ideas of, you know, classical portraiture and community art, because you just don't see that very often.
Vasquez chose a group of diverse subjects to expertly render. One is Natasha Kahn, a 29-year-old from Two Rivers.
I thought it was amazing. I knew beforehand that she was an amazing artist, but just seeing it was like, it was so weird at first because you usually don't see yourself like that.
The show is designed to inspire Manitowoc residents to consider how they do see themselves. Dozens of self-portraits are exhibited alongside Vasquez's paintings, displayed between two pieces of glass. On the back, each artist answered a prompt: how do you feel about your identity in relation to Manitowoc? Kahn wrote about struggling to balance her Pakistani heritage with her Wisconsin upbringing.
I think it's just a great way for people to see different representations of our community, and hopefully they can see representations of themselves and realize that their identity and self is important.
Museum goers might see their neighbors or friends among the artworks. The portraits are all different. Vasquez pointed out a work from a 79-year-old artist who signed her portrait as Gloria. She made a collage featuring daffodils, a cardinal, and one of America's most beloved daughters, whose own work often deals with identity, Dolly Parton. The works from students have resonated with Bolander. Many are wearing masks in their self-portraits, documenting this very specific moment in time. And she says it's been powerful to read people's personal descriptions.
And I feel like it's sort of cleansing in a way for some people. And it's been a real mix, like people who maybe have some suggestions on how to make the community better, and also people who really just love it here and want everyone to feel welcome.
Part of the museum is housed in an 1880s home. Bolander says it's literally a mansion on a hill. She knows it's not a place everyone feels comfortable visiting, especially during the pandemic. So the exhibit will travel after it closes at the Rahr West on June 6th.
Sonia has designed it so that we'll be able to send it to other locations after it's here. So people who might not feel comfortable coming here to the museum, maybe they'll feel more comfortable going to a local school or the library.
Bolander and Vasquez want the exhibit to be accessible, and they agree representation is important.
I'm super grateful to have a museum and have people that work at the museum that are super open to making their own museum more diverse.
Vasquez is 28 and half Mexican. She says it hasn't always been easy to connect with that side of her culture in Manitowoc, but she sees the community changing.
I think genuinely most people in the city are, you know, are caring, loving people that, you know, want to have a nice community. But I think there's a lot of learning still to be done.
WPR's Megan Hart brought us that story on the art exhibit Portrait of Manitowoc at the Rahr West Art Museum. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, racial trauma is making the Derek Chauvin trial too hard to watch for some people. We'll talk with a holistic mental health expert about the trauma that many Black Americans carry. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For the last 2 weeks, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been on trial facing charges of manslaughter and murder in the death of George Floyd. The trials involved detailed testimonies of the events of that day, recalled by often crying witnesses, and the replaying of videos. Many Americans, especially Black Americans, for which this story is too familiar, are dealing with trauma and pain and re-traumatization watching these events right now. Marielle Bouquet is a licensed psychologist, holistic mental health expert, and sound bath meditation healer. Her work focuses on healing wounds of intergenerational trauma. Marielle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me and centering this conversation.
As a trauma therapist, Marielle, what are you thinking about as these images go out, these videos go out, this trial gets covered? What is on your mind as people are watching this and maybe feeling that trauma all over again?
Yeah, well, I hold for sure deep concern for the Black community and the ways in which we are currently being impacted in our minds, our bodies, our spirits. We carry it kind of all over, the grief and the pain that we experience as a result of the vicarious trauma that is likely to happen to any individual within the Black community as a result of the exposure and re-exposure of the death of a community member and a loved member of the diaspora.
And Marielle, I think a lot of times when we think about trauma, we think about individual treatment for a person and what they can do about it. And we can get into that in a few moments. From what I understand, you are hoping we look at wider issues too, institutional causes of the kind of trauma that you're talking about that. Can you talk about what that looks like and what solutions you're hoping to see?
Absolutely. So the institutional climate of America and really kind of the world, right, is one in which there is a very pervasive racial oppression that just really permeates throughout society that makes it so that trauma and everyday stress that is race-related is a common occurrence. And so it's important for us to have that understanding at the center of our knowledge base around the multiple systems that we have to be a part of as a result of just living mostly in America, right? And the fact that the thing about trauma is that it, you know, trauma is the experience that a person has when our internal coping no longer suffices to actually help with the stressor. So the stressor is either acute enough or longstanding enough that it makes it so that a person's resources and capacities to cope with the stressor have been depleted. And when you think about racial oppression and when you think about the flawed system around law and order in the United States, and the ways in which it perpetuates acute stress for Black Americans, then you start connecting the dots around, like, how is it that trauma actually makes its way into Black homes, into Black communities, and how is it that it is sustained within these communities? And it makes it so that Black individuals don't really experience respite from the ongoing stress and the ongoing trauma. What I would like to see is a real overhaul of the systems that are perpetuating this kind of emotional violence upon Black individuals. That is, we have to get at the core of what is actually really what one might say even diseased, right? Like there is something that is happening within the system that is causing the pain to the people. And so we have to get at the core of what is causing the mental unwellness in order to actually make sure that the actual trauma isn't tapping into the next generation in the ways that it has in generations past and in the current generation.
Now, for people, Black people living through this now, you know, those longer-term solutions aren't there for them today when they go to social media or turn on the TV. What do you say to them as they see these events and feel that trauma of watching yet another story like this and yet another trial like this?
What I would urge people to understand is that their Black minds matter and that it's important for people to take good care of their minds because we can become not only mentally unwell, but physically unwell as a result of the influx of information that is coming our way that is threatening, is horrifying, is fear-inducing. And so there are several ways in which people can take care, right? I mean, one of the ways that is, I think, of widespread understanding of what to do is to limit the amount of information that a person is internalizing around either the case or anything that's happening within the Black community, and to just do that by understanding what their own limitations are. And sometimes that's a little hard to gauge, right? But if a person is willing to maybe tap into the news or into any source that is actually providing them with some sort of a recap of the current events only at a specific time in the day, and within that time frame that they've actually decided to engage in the content, that they may also have some sort of self-care strategy or community support or their mental health clinician on call or some sort of a process that can actually help them to self-sustain and be well, even while they're taking in this information, is probably the wisest thing to do. It's important for us to be very strategic around how we take in this information, understanding that it doesn't always happen that way, that sometimes the information can be so spontaneous and sometimes, you know, the information can be so consistent, right, that it can be really hard to filter out. But it's best if people are able, that they can engage in a filtering process, take in what they can and take in what is needed, and then also have a plan in place for how to take care.
I want to spend the last couple of minutes, Mariel, on how people can self-identify trauma. Because as I understand it, whether it's from an individual bad experience or a cumulative experience of years of a lifetime, people might feel bad, but they might not identify this as a reaction to trauma. How can we identify that in ourselves?
Well, the thing about trauma is that it actually is a diagnostic term, right? So trauma, it has to be ascribed by a mental health clinician, someone that's been trained and understands really the full scope of trauma, understands the time frames that we need for a person to be presenting with symptoms in order to identify it as trauma. However, a person can at least understand what elements of the world that they're living in and the exposure that they're having to the trial and to other elements of violence upon Black bodies that creates triggers for them. And I think that that is language that I think can be perhaps more easily accessible outside of a clinical relationship, where we understand that if we are triggered, that there are certain ways in which that's interpreted in our minds. Let's say, you know, we may feel more irritable than usual, or perhaps there may be the experience of us having ongoing sadness for a few days, right? And so being able to understand that there is a genuine emotional impact and that that impact is coming from a direct trigger that is connected to the very trial or other areas of our lives. And so that's something. And then, you know, the way in which the body also interprets it. Sometimes we experience a lot of tension in our bodies. And if that's tension that's there and isn't really promoted by other aspects of our lives, if everything else feels like it's in flow, however, you're engaging in ongoing content around violence upon Black bodies, then that might be a clue that a trigger is happening and that your body is capturing that trigger.
Mariel, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Mariel Bouquet is a licensed psychologist and holistic mental health expert. Her work focuses on healing wounds of intergenerational trauma. She joined us today to talk about how the trial of Derek Chauvin may be re-traumatizing many Black Americans. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Abraham Lincoln spent time in Wisconsin during his career. Kate talks to the author of the new book, Lincoln Among the Badgers. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's our week in Washington. We'll talk about President Biden's announcement today to pull all remaining U.S. forces out of Afghanistan. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.